X-29, number 6B.
What is it in our mentality that tries to disintegrate that which is integrated? What is that inconsistency that objects to consistency? What is that desolatory thinking which is so antagonistic to coherent reasoning? The following seven subjects answer this for us. The first subject states that human opinions cannot prevent truth from being scientifically practical, mind. We must see that science is the law of mind, which cannot be influenced by false states of mind. Objections based on mere opinions cannot change the invariable law of Christianity. Hence, our attitude should not be one of sneering, decrying, misrepresenting, denouncing, disputing, or condemning this science of Christianity, but one of meekness and spirituality. Being receptive in thought and poor in spirit clears away these objections. Let us watch, therefore, when we are faced with a problem, that we do not lend an ear to the arguments of mortal mind, of the human mind, of general opinions and beliefs. Then we shall not rob the unity of being of its imminent scientific correctness. In her second subject, Mrs. Eddy depicts that the distinction between God's man and Adam, between the spiritual and the material, must be clearly understood, spirit. People often regard the science of Christianity as contradictory because they cannot distinguish properly between spiritual man as God's own image and likeness and material man or Adam. They fail to see the difference between God's man and poor humanity. They confound spiritual manhood with sinful, material, corporeal manhood. They cannot perceive the incongruity of immortal man and mortal man. This confusion leads to the absurd conclusion that God, spirit, works through matter or heals through matter. Wanting to serve both spirit and matter, God and mammon, is one of the main obstructions to demonstration. As long as we have a dual sense of substance in mind, we object to pure Christianity and so deprive ourselves of its fruits. The third subject explains that only spiritual sense and spiritual apprehension can grasp the spiritual meaning of the workings of truth, soul. Christian science is frequently objected to because people try to understand and judge spiritual things and spiritual demonstrations through material sense. They consider sin, sickness, and death as real identities and defend them as facts. We can deal with these objections only by seeing clearly that spiritual things can be understood through spiritual sense alone. Consequently, we must gain the spiritual meaning of Christian science and apprehend truth spiritually. Relying on sense testimony, we disrupt our true sense of manhood. The fourth subject shows that only a scientific understanding, not a religious faith, can demonstrate the divine principle. Many people object to the practicability and demonstrability of Christian science because they themselves lack demonstration due to their own deficiency in scientific understanding of the divine principle. Either they have no trust at all in God as a present help, or their trust is based on a mere religious faith, a personal devil, or an anthropomorphic God. Blind faith in God, trust in an unknown God, lacks scientific demonstration. These very beliefs in our mentality object to a scientifically demonstrable Christianity. The fifth subject is one I like very much. Through it, Mrs. Eddy makes it quite plain that in order to be able to demonstrate the reality of life, the ghost of materiality must be given up, life. We may not believe in ghosts haunting castles, but are we not all largely haunted by the ghosts of materiality? We still believe far too much in material existence, in organic matter, in life in matter, which is nothing more than a spectacular ghostly farce. If life is spiritual, it is spiritual and in no sense material. To take material life as life is to believe in a ghost. If we love materiality, we have sold ourselves to ghosts. So our belief and love for materiality must be given up. In fact, we must give up the ghost. Unless we do, we obstruct demonstration, for we are tempted to look for life in matter. The sixth subject teaches that contradictory, inconsistent, absurd, and false reasoning is not of the nature of truth. The very nature of truth we see here is that it is consistent in itself, whereas sin is inconsistent. If we are consistent in our reasoning and in drawing logical conclusions from truth, then truth demonstrates itself. Christian Science is consistent, as its statements lead to proof. On the other hand, Christian opponents to Christian Science are inconsistent insofar as they confess to Jesus' words but do not repeat Jesus' works. The statements of Christian Science seem contradictory only to the worldly and material-minded. To the spiritually-minded, they are consistent. Many people start from some truth, but are inconsistent in drawing logical conclusions as to what this truth and all its many aspects involves. Inconsistency arrives at contradictory conclusions, and so prevents demonstration. The seventh subject gives us the climax, showing that through spiritually scientific understanding, all is gathered into one consistent whole, love. Love demands complete unity. Here in this subject, Mrs. Eddy urges us to know ourselves spiritually and scientifically in man's perfection. In other words, we must gather into one all ideas constituting spiritual man. Furthermore, we are told that as Christian Scientists, we should bring out but one ideal, the ideal of God, which is always perfect. Having but one God, one ideal, and one man would unite all men, Jews and Christians alike, in doctrine and demonstration. It would eliminate disunity, and all interests would be gathered into one. In this same vein also is the last paragraph of the chapter, in which Mrs. Eddy says that many revisions of science and health were necessary in order to arrive at one correct, consistent, coherent, scientific statement of Christian Science. As Christian Scientists, we must know man as one idea. We must bring out but one ideal, God's ideal. We must see all relationships as one infinite reflection, and we must grasp science as one coherent statement. Then no objection can any more disrupt this oneness. I think it is most enlightening to compare the beginning of the chapter with the end. At the beginning, Mrs. Eddy writes that the scriptures grow in beauty and consistency from one grand root. In the same way, Christian Science grows from one grand root, the one divine principle, and we have to accept this one principle in its entirety and oneness in order to be able to demonstrate it. If we can reject the objections running through the seven subjects, we leave the unity of God and His infinite ideas intact. Thus, we arrive at that wonderful sense of unity, which we get on the last page of the chapter, where Mrs. Eddy writes, "I and my Father are one, that is, one in quality, not in quantity. As a drop of water is one with the ocean, a ray of light one with the sun, even so God and man, Father and Son, are one in being." The scripture reads, "For in Him we live and move and have our being." Science and Health 361:15-20. Have you ever stopped to think what such a statement implies? Have you ever thought of a drop and the ocean? A drop of water on your hand is just a drop of water. But if you put that drop of water into the ocean, it is still a drop of water. Yet there is an enormous difference. An isolated drop on your hand cannot do very much, as its qualities are limited. But if you take the same drop of water and put it into the ocean, it acquires, through relationship with other drops, many more qualities. It becomes oceanic. Being one with the ocean, it can carry boats and ships. It provides an element for fishes. It can form waves. It can gather power and do many other things, which, as an isolated drop, it cannot do. Can you see what coherency can accomplish? In the same way, if we take an idea of God out of its infinite coherency, this isolated idea can do nothing. In fact, it even loses the right to the name of idea. But if we see the idea in its infinite relationship to all other ideas, then this same idea gathers infinitely more qualities. It gathers magnitude, momentum, power, expression, and the effectiveness of all other ideas together. It has no longer just its own qualities, but reflects also the qualities of all other ideas. This is the pith of the whole chapter, Some Objections Answered. It shows that in consciousness, we must always grasp an idea in its relationship to all other ideas. Otherwise, we disrupt the consistency of the divine system. We must therefore see the idea of man not in a drop sense, but in an oceanic sense. This chapter conveys the sense that an idea reflects all other ideas, and thus gives an illustration of the infinite space. Of space not in a spatial way, but as the infinite realm of mutual reflection. This is the standpoint which we can denote as Christianity reflecting Christianity. Briefly considering the seven subjects again, we can ask ourselves, what is it that tries to obstruct demonstration? Or, in other words, what is it that tries to disrupt man's unity with God and the universe? And we find that it is the lack of scientific thinking and scientific reasoning, mind. The lack of always distinguishing distinctly between the spiritual as real and the material as unreal, between God's man and the Adam man, spirit. The lack of relying on the testimony of spiritual sense instead of the testimony of the material senses, soul. the lack of trusting a scientific principle instead of trusting dogmatic religion. Principle. The lack of giving up the ghost of materiality, the love for materiality, life, the lack of coherent, consistent logic in words and deeds, truth, and the lack of understanding the unity, oneness, and wholeness of being. Our lack of seeing that we live and move and have our being in God. The lack of seeing ourselves one with God and one with the whole universe, love. If we can meet these different lacks, then we understand an idea in its consistency and coherency as a pure spiritual idea in consciousness, and nothing any longer stands in the way to wholeness or health. As we have seen, all these objections were to separate statement from proof, and clearing them away in our mentality, we arrive at the point where we are equipped to prove the statements of Christian Science. Thus, we are ready for the next chapter, for the practice of Christian Science. Christian Science Practice. Some objections answered ended with the unity, wholeness, and perfection of being as a complete idea of the divine principle. This divine principle is stated in the textbook, and Mrs. Eddy, as she tells us in the last paragraph of that chapter, was very anxious through repeated revisions of the textbook to give a coherent and correct explanation of this principle. Now that the coherent scientific text has dealt with the fundamental objections, the way is prepared to use this science in a practical manner in order to deal with every possible problem. This scientific application of spiritual ideas is explained in Christian Science Practice, written from the standpoint of Christianity reflecting science. It is the standpoint where we knowingly, consciously, use the realm of ideas for solving practical problems. As John W. Dorley has already elucidated the structure of this chapter in his book, Christian Science Practice, all I want to do is to touch on the main lines of the chapter in order to show you how it fits into the whole textbook, Our Way of Life. Most of the captions I shall be giving you for the various subjects are taken from this book. This chapter has four parts. The first part goes to Science and Health, 367-29, and has as its main theme a blending of love and mind, depicting the loving state of mind of the practitioner. The second part, which goes to page 386-15, is pervaded by a combination of truth and mind, showing the Christ truth made manifest as idea. The third part, ending with page 410-21, is dominated by a combination of life and soul, stating that being is always identified. Mental Treatment Illustrated, the fourth part, presents love, truth, and life again, but in their blending with spirit, that is, in their universal reflection. It illustrates that the practitioner's consciousness of love, truth, and life, as depicted in the first three parts, must be reflected in the patient's thought and everywhere. This is what might be called a preview of what we are going to contemplate together in this chapter. Do not think of this structure as complicated. As we go on, you will see that it is very warm, comforting, and beautiful. First part. As I said, the first part is pervaded by the overall theme of love and mind. What does this mean? It means that its standpoint is love constantly beholding love's idea, Love is the fulfillment of all things and operates through the science of mind healing, through a right mental attitude. Christianity is based on the perfection of love and the allness of mind operating throughout all space. Therefore, the Christianity of love and mind knows and considers all evil as animal magnetism, or nothing, and all that is good as an idea of divine mind. So the practitioner who goes out from this standpoint must have a mentality of infinite perfection, completion, and fulfillment. He must start from the summit of love, which holds in thought nothing but perfection. Or, as the text puts it, he must have a benign thought. He must regard the patient compassionately. He must have the mentality of unselfish affection, a recognition of infinite love, and must already see the consummation of his vision. Can you hear the tone of love and mind which must permeate the practitioner's attitude? Thus, practice starts out from love and mind, from a vision of the infinite perfection of the universe, from the infinite realm of ideas which excludes error and illusions as nothing. The keynote initiating the chapter is, "Thy sins are forgiven." A practitioner's practice goes out from the point where he has already scientifically forgiven, where the divine pardon has already been reached. His thought must dwell in the fullness of ideas. Let us consider what love's mentality affects and accomplishes. The first subject tells us that love's mentality attracts the patient, the needing thought, the seeker, mind. Here, Mrs. Eddy relates how Jesus' mentality of compassion attracted Mary Magdalene, how the light broke on her and impelled her to approach Jesus, from whom she gained complete forgiveness. If we take into our consciousness the full sense that divine love knows only its own idea of perfection, this operates as attraction to every receptive thought. The second subject shows that love's mentality operates as true discernment, as divine insight, spirit. Jesus' mentality had divine insight into the Magdalene's thought and could discern her love for purity, goodness, and spirituality. This brought her absolution. A true practitioner can always detect a flicker of spirituality in the patient's thought and will always strengthen and develop it and not quench the smoking flax. The third subject points out that love's mentality brings about true repentance, soul. Jesus' benign thought brought to the patient, the Magdalene, repentance, reformation, and resurrection. Because it was unselfish and never identified the patient as sinful. The fourth subject explains that love's mentality operates as pure demonstration, principle. Love's mentality is shown to be spiritual power, and if the Christian Scientist's thought is filled with love, it demonstrates spiritual power. It mobilizes the patient's spiritual power to resuscitate himself. In the fifth subject, we see that love's mentality demands the laying down of the mortal concept through love, life. The practitioner's thought must be rich with the knowledge of God's allness. He must be free himself of moral evils, of spiritual barrenness, and mental penury, else he cannot meet a lack and cure the patient. Through the sixth subject, we learn that love's mentality demands the standard of true manhood, truth. In order to demonstrate manhood in the patient, the practitioner must grow into Christian manhood himself. He must seek truth with the love for truth and must be the light of the world himself. The last subject teaches that love's mentality brings full consummation, love. Love's idea always welcomes the student to ever higher attainments. Mrs. Eddy, as a practitioner and teacher, longed to share her fullness of vision with her patients and students. This first part is really an interplay of the practitioner's mentality and the patient's reactions. It is as if Mrs. Eddy would show here the divine law of supply and demand. She illustrates how the divine supply, in this case, the practitioner's attitude, awakens and meets the real need of the patient. If we look back over the seven subjects, we can gather what the attitude of the practitioner must be. He must forgive all, mind. He must be good and pure himself, spirit. He must be unselfish, soul. He must win his own pardon, principle. He must first cast moral evils out of himself, life. He must himself have grown into the stature of Christian manhood, truth. And he must yearn to see the fulfillment of his hope, love. What are the patient's reactions to this attitude? From the text, we gather that he is irresistibly attracted to love's healing mind, that he repents, baptizes his thoughts, and becomes receptive to spiritual good, spirit, that he reforms and resurrects himself, soul, that his spiritual power operates as resuscitation, principle, that his thoughts are flooded by life, life, that he inherits his health, his Christ, consciousness, truth, and thereby attains a higher light and achievement, love. Let us always bear in mind, however, that even though we speak about the practitioner's mentality, it is not his person and not his thoughts, but the realization of the ever-operative principle that does the work and heals the patient. Second part. The first part depicted the standpoint of love's Christianity, the summit from which the practitioner looks out, the mentality of love, knowing and beholding its own perfect idea and the whole plan of fulfillment of that idea. That idea, of course, has a Christ. And the second part illustrates the operation of this Christ, the operation of this ideal. The first part thus links us with the second part, which has the overall tone of truth and mind. What is the meaning of truth and mind here? Words are of no use unless we know what they stand for. The combination of truth and mind conveys here the meaning of the Christ, truth, brought right down to the point of manifestation in mind, to the point of recognition, of comprehension, of intelligent thought. We find here the Christ as the divine manifestation of God in its office of healing, whereby the Christ translates itself to the point of idea, to the point of understanding, and even to the point of mentality. In this second part, the Christ mind operates to annihilate its counterfeit beliefs, the mind of the Antichrist. The text teems with combinations in the counterfeit sense of truth and mind. For instance, the Christ, truth, deals here with erroneous mortal beliefs, false beliefs, mortal blindness, erroneous mental practices, illusions as the source of sickness, the mental origin of disease, and so on. Moreover, these counterfeits are annihilated through the Christ mind, the true sense of truth and mind, which operates through a true mental state, through an apprehension of truth, through the comprehension of facts, through the power of truth, through the facts of health whispered into thought, through the truth of being whispered into the ear of mortal mind, through the might of intelligence exercised over mortal beliefs to destroy them, through the action of truth on the minds of mortals, and the corresponding effect of truth on the body, and so on.